Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and we are here today with Christy Thornton, who is an assistant professor in the sociology department at Johns Hopkins University. We've had Christy on before, actually, to discuss her book, Revolution and Development, Mexico and the Governance of the Global Economy. So if you haven't read that book yet or heard that podcast, please do. But the reason we have her here today is that last week, September 7th, to be precise, she had an excellent op-ed in the New York Times titled, "The U.S. has led the war on drugs abroad for decades, and it's been a staggering failure." And we thought this would be an excellent time to discuss the war on drugs a little bit. So, Christy, thank you again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what led you to write this op-ed, and what do you want readers to get out of it?
Yeah, so there's a couple kind of things that are going on right now in U.S. drug policy that are really interesting. And one of the problems that I see is that the way we think about how the U.S. has waged the war on drugs over the last 50 years, really since the Nixon administration, is sort of bifurcated between drug policy here in the United States, which, you know, has to do with questions about over-policing and mass incarceration and racial disparity and the kinds of results that it has in neighborhoods, you know, here in the United States, now being addressed by people working in public health and those kinds of questions. And then a totally separate conversation about U.S. foreign policy and the way that the war on drugs overseas is prosecuted and the results there for human rights and environmental devastation and the rise in violence. And so, you know, I teach a class here at Johns Hopkins called The Political Economy of Drugs and Drug Wars. And we talk about these things a lot, why these two realms are really separate. You know, there are really important changes happening now in kind of U.S. domestic drug policy. There's finally a recognition from the highest levels that the way we've waged this war on drugs domestically isn't working. It's not keeping people safe. It's not reducing drug consumption. It's fueling mass incarceration. But there hasn't been a kind of similar reckoning with the U.S. overseas drug war. And so I wanted to use this piece to kind of make the case that those two things are inextricable, that we can't, you know, of course, we need to change U.S. domestic drug policy, but that if we continue with a kind of militarized drug war overseas, we will continue producing the conditions for an increasingly unsafe supply of drugs here to the United States. So I really wanted to be able to put those two things together and think about the domestic and the foreign kind of in the same breath.
Yeah, I mean, you're the real expert here, of course. And you know, I talk about some of this stuff. You know, I teach the U.S. foreign policy course since 1890. And so we spend some time on this. And, you know, one thing I try to emphasize to students that I don't think they quite get is that a lot of the issues happening in Latin America, you know, whether it's migration, environmental change, violence, are really related to a lot of activities happening in the United States. And yet we often just don't make those connections between domestic U.S. policy and our foreign policy toward Latin America, particularly the Andes and Mexico and Central America.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, what it comes down to is this idea of that has underpinned U.S. Foreign drug policy since the 1980s of source eradication. There's this idea that U.S. can use military forces, that it can train other countries' militaries and security forces to go out there and go after the producers, the kind of source producers of drugs. Now, what that means is, of course, the drug traffickers themselves, the kind of, and we could talk about the myth of the drug cartel and what a drug cartel actually is and how, you know, drug trafficking organizations have changed their organization in the course of the neoliberal transition. But, you know, they go after the drug traffickers, but then also going after, you know, small scale producers, the people who actually farm coca and cannabis and opium poppies. And of course, doing that requires things like burning hectares of fields, spraying with, you know, chemicals like glyphosate, and really militarizing the kinds of regions where these drugs are grown, which tend, of course, to be poor, rural, largely indigenous, and in Colombia, Afro-descendant, right? And so the areas where the United States has really fueled this militarization have been the ones where we have seen, you know, massive increases in violence, huge numbers of people displaced, disappeared, murdered, tortured in Colombia, in Mexico, now increasingly in Central America. And they are also places where, you know, these eradication attempts, what they do is they actually push the drug production into other areas. And so there's this well-known thing called the balloon effect, where clamping down on production in one place just squeezes the balloon, squeezes the air in the balloon, makes it go somewhere else. And what researchers have shown is that, in fact, what's happening is that it's fueling things like deforestation and environmental degradation, right? If drug growers need to go sort of further and further away from the prying eye of the state, where are they going to go? They're going to go into protected nature reserves. They're going to go further into jungles and forests. And river deltas, right? And so in that way, we see increasing environmental devastation, which then in turn drives more displacement, which drives migration. All of these things are entirely connected.
And if you're a person who really believes that drugs are evil, you know, or whatever, has any of this actually worked to limit the drug supply in the United States?
No, I mean, that's the kind of overwhelming thing. And, you know, to the credit of the Biden administration, Biden brought in the first medical doctor to occupy the position of drug czar, really since the Nixon administration left the idea of treatment behind in the early 1970s. So Dr. Rahul Gupta, he was the health commissioner in the state of West Virginia. He saw firsthand what the overdose crisis looked like there, right? Higher per capita overdose rates than anywhere else in the country. So he knew that the way that we had been prosecuting the drug war here at home, trying to lock up users, lock up drug dealers, right? Those things weren't working. So to his credit, and it's actually an incredible change. He has said the federal government is going to put resources toward harm reduction for the first time. It's an incredible thing to have the U.S. federal government come out and say harm reduction works. We understand that people are going to use drugs. We are going to try and stop them from dying, from getting diseases, from overdosing. But what hasn't happened is a similar recognition that the way the U.S. has led this drug war overseas also hasn't worked, right? Gupta goes before Congress and he says, you know, we can't just keep doing the same thing, banging our head against the wall, policy that doesn't work. But we need to apply that analysis to the overseas drug war as well, because in fact, analyses by the UN, by the DEA themselves show that now, you know, 2022, drugs are cheaper, they are more plentiful, and they're stronger and more deadly than they've ever been before. So all of these, the long 40 years of this militarized attempt at source control, in fact, has contributed to the overdose crisis here, because what it has done is it has pushed drug traffickers to find cheaper, easier to transport, less able to detect sources of profit. And so what does that do? It pushes traffickers to move from cannabis in the 1970s and 1980s toward cocaine and heroin in the 1980s and 1990s. It then pushes into the manufacturing of methamphetamines in the 1990s into the 2000s. And now today it's fueling the move towards synthetic opioids like fentanyl, right? Fentanyl, you know, it's much more potent. You can carry much less of it across a border, sell it for just as much money, and have it actually have these staggering results here. So not only have they failed to kind of wipe out the supply of drugs, they have actually created incentives to make the drugs more dangerous to the people who are using them here. And that's the ultimate connection between the overseas policy and the domestic policy. We can address this with harm reduction here at home, but unless we stop creating the incentives for drug trafficking organizations to make profits on these new, you know, incredibly dangerous synthetics, and, you know, the innovation is going to continue. The innovation has happened for the last 50 years. And, you know, this is the market. These are drug trafficking. Traffickers are market operators. They are responding to market signals. And so as the U.S. government creates the incentives for this kind of innovation, it will continue to create the conditions for drug trafficking organizations to create more and more dangerous, less well understood drugs coming into the United States. And so, you know, we know now drug use globally is up. The UN reported it's up 26% over a decade ago. Fully a quarter more people are using drugs today around the world than were a decade ago. Nothing about the way that we have prosecuted this war here at home or abroad has worked. And what I really want is for the Biden administration to recognize that it has the power. It is the global leader here. And they need to take the stand to say, yes, we've recognized that the domestic drug war hasn't worked, but the overseas drug war hasn't worked either. And we need to end militarized source control. We need to end the way that we have run this for the last 50 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I find remarkable here is that in the last half a century, you have a huge variety of presidents and policies on domestic issues. But the international war on drugs just seems to be, you know, an unquestioned assumption that hasn't changed all that much, no matter, you know, which party is in power. And the continued bipartisan support for, you know, this kind of militarization in Latin America strikes me as not only foolish, but also kind of amazing that people in power have not really questioned that.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is, you know, we certainly saw this ramp up after 9/11, the idea that anything that has to do with quote unquote national security is going to be unquestioned in our foreign policy world, right? And so the drug war has been written into that kind of narrative. And you've seen this, actually, this goes back long before the kind of what we think of as the contemporary drug war with Nixon, right? And you know this history. It goes all the way back to, you know, the arrival of Chinese immigrants bringing with them a habit of smoking opium on the West Coast in the late 19th century. It goes to Mexican immigrants after the Mexican Revolution arriving to work in mines and fields and bringing with them cannabis. So the kind of racialization of an outside drug threat is a long story that the United States has told. There's a kind of imagined pure white body politic and these foreign racialized drugs that are coming in to really pollute that body. And so it's been very easy, you know, for more than a century for the United States, for our representatives to tell this story about the way that drugs are kind of coming from elsewhere. And, you know, what that means is that, you know, particularly in the late 20th and early 21st century, you begin to get, as you said, this bipartisan consensus. And I can see this in the Biden administration. Like, I had conversations with Dr. Gupta, with his chief of staff. Like, I've been talking to the people at the Office of National Drug Control Policy. And what they said to me is basically, the Republicans will never let us change this, right? They will come after us as kind of soft on crime, on narco terrorists. And so there's a way in which, and we see this in many realms, right? The Democrats hampered themselves from the beginning by saying, this is politically impossible, right? It is politically impossible. And, you know, what the chief of staff of the ONDCP said to me was, look, source control has these kinds of measurable outcomes. We can say we burned this many hectares, we seized this many kilos, we imprisoned this many kingpins. If we take a different kind of non-militarized approach, what are the measurables here? How do we know that we're succeeding? And, you know, I think we should know that we're succeeding when, you know, we don't have literally 8 million people internally displaced in Colombia, when we don't have 100,000 people forcibly disappeared in Mexico, right? But that idea that, you know, the Republicans will come after those in, you know, Democrats in power by saying that they are soft on kind of drug lords and narco terrorists, it is a perpetuation of this machine that keeps funneling money into, quite frankly, defense contractors, right? The people who really win from the overseas drug war are General Dynamics and Sikorsky and Raytheon, right? And Monsanto, the people who provide the actual materiel. And so, you know, you can see that the senators in places like California or Connecticut, they don't want those contracts for, you know, helicopters and surveillance drones to go away. Of course they don't, right? But again, this is part of the way in which we have long been willing to spend, you know, government money on these kinds of repressive apparatuses without recognizing the ways that they are, or in spite of the ways that they are reverberating here at home to make us less safe, less free, less secure.
Yeah, it sounds like the justification in the Vietnam War about body counts. You know, we can make up this number, and, you know, regardless of whether it's effective or not, it's a number that we can throw out there to show that we're winning this unwinnable war.
Right. So Pablo Escobar is dead. You know, El Chapo Guzman is in prison, and, you know, 100,000 people overdosed last year here in the United States and died. Like, what difference does those kingpins being jailed, those hectares being burned, those kilos being seized, what is it actually doing? It has no demonstrable effect on the safety of people here in the United States. And so I think that the Biden administration really has this chance because they've taken this kind of risky and strong stance on harm reduction here at home. And they got pushback, right? I don't know if you remember, a few months ago, there was this incredible moment where, you know, right-wing Republicans, kind of MAGA Republicans, seized on the harm reduction thing and said, Joe Biden is sending people crack pipes. We're using, you know, federal money to send people crack pipes. And that was because there is kind of safe supply mandates in the harm reduction money, right? So people are, you know, just as we do needle exchange so that people are not using dirty needles and having communicable diseases spread, right? The idea here is not let people get sick from the ways that they use drugs, right? So that we might keep them alive, move them into treatment, right? Make their lives better, et cetera. But, you know, the Republicans are going to push back, but, you know, Biden has the bully pulpit here. And particularly because every leader around the world recognizes that this is true, right? You have in Latin America in 2016, when the UN General Assembly special session on drugs happened, there was an incredible op-ed in the Los Angeles Times from a range of Latin American leaders, you know, right-wing kind of neoliberal leaders, not, I mean, Petro is on the left, right? The new government of Colombia, but you know, there is a broad consensus that the global drug war has not only not worked, not achieved its goals, right? But that it has been incredibly dangerous and detrimental in quote unquote source countries. So Biden has the backing of the rest of the world. They have the chance to kind of seize this moment and say the global drug war doesn't work, right? We need to think about new solutions, despite what, you know, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz will stand up and do. They really have that chance. And, you know, I said this directly to Dr. Gupta, you know, to his chief of staff. I said, you have the chance to seize this and change the narrative. And I really think the Biden administration could take this moment. Gupta just went to Bogota. He met with Petro. He met with Francia Marquez. He, you know, saw some kind of alternative development programs. They have the opportunity right now. And that's what I hope to do with the piece, to say, you have the opportunity to make the kind of, even just the first rhetorical step, they made it in domestic policy by saying we are embracing harm reduction, something that had never been done before. Take that step with regard to the foreign policy, because they're linked together. You can't have success in one area without having success in the other.
Well, let me ask you one last question then, and I'll let you go, which is that, you know, I'm wondering if you see signs that there is some change going on here at the elite level. I mean, the fact that the New York Times would publish this is the suggestion that you can at least have this conversation in acceptable, you know, center-left political discourse in 2022, which you probably could not have in 1992. So, you know, maybe that's progress. I don't know. But do you see, you know, in Congress or among, you know, among internal powerful people within the government, do you see signs that there is the potential for some shift here?
I hope so. And I do think, again, there is a kind of growing global consensus about this across the political spectrum. So you have the Global Drug Policy Initiative, you have all of these kinds of broad-based, that, you know, even at the UN, these kinds of broad-based recognition that the way that the drug war has worked for the last 50 years doesn't work. The thing that underpins it, the kind of base on which that whole global prohibitionist regime rests, is the US notion of a quote unquote drug-free world, right? That's what the United States, that's the thing that underpins what the United States, the way that it pursues. And so, you know, people were really hopeful during the Obama administration. And I should say that many of the policies of the Obama administration have now been brought back in by Biden. People were hopeful during the Obama administration that he was actually going to make this change. And there was this important 2016 meeting that I just mentioned, the General Assembly special session. And the Obama administration stonewalled it, right? And what the ONDCP told me was, look, we had a particular amount of political capital and we weren't going to kind of go to the mat for what was happening at the UN General Assembly at that moment. I think that even since 2016, as we've seen, you know, not only kind of broad-based recognition of the legalization of cannabis around the country, the staggering numbers of overdose deaths that have happened. You know, we have over 1 million people have died of overdose in the last 20 years, and 100,000 of them, 107,000 of that was last year alone, right? It's a huge acceleration in how people are overdosing. Those things have really made people recognize that there is a disconnect here. And so I do think that, you know, getting this in the New York Times, having people at ONDCP who really care about this, the chief of staff used to work at the Washington office on Latin America, right? They know these things are true. It's just about finding the kind of political backbone and the political will to pursue this in the face of what will continue to be the kind of obstructionist push from, you know, right wingers like Rubio and Cruz.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we can, you know, we can hope. And I think that at the very least, you know, keeping these conversations on the front burner are important, in part because I think that the U.S., you know, including the U.S. left, doesn't really talk that much about Latin America right now. I mean, it's kind of disappeared a little bit from the from the kind of global vision of even a lot of progressives. And so I think that's a really sad thing, given the larger impact of U.S. foreign policy in this area, as you have discussed. So once again, we have been speaking with Christy Thornton of Johns Hopkins University about her September 7th op-ed in the New York Times. The U.S. has led the war on drugs abroad for decades, and it's been a staggering failure. And we will be back again soon with another Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. Thank you again, Christy.
Thanks.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.